meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We're calling tonight's show, or part of tonight's show, The Anatomy of a Crime. What is that? Well, we hear and we see and we read about crime stories where we get maybe one side, maybe two. You have some talking heads on to talk about what happened. Not often do you hear from everyone involved. We're going to try and do that tonight, get everyone involved except the accused in this situation. So we're going to have a victim. We're going to have the family of the victim. We're going to have a police officer. We're going to have a DA. And we're going to have a victim's advocate, someone that helps the victim. And we're going to talk about a story, a true story, something that happened. In this case, it's a horrific domestic violence issue, rape, you name it. If there are young children around, you may not want them to hear part of this, but I want you to listen to all of this because it is such an important story that we cover it from A to Z. What we're going to do at the end of the segment is we're going to ask the guests, is the system working? The system that we have right now is a good system. It's the best we've got, but does it need help? Well, we're going to tell in just a few minutes. Reagan is here. Cherry is here. Reagan is the victim. Cherry is the victim's mom. We have Stacy Dietrich, who's a police officer, an author, someone who has investigated these types of crimes many times. Robin Sachs is here. She's a DA, Los Angeles County. Susan Murphy Milano is here. She is a victim's advocate, someone who helps victims. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
What we're going to do, or how we're going to do this, is we're going to start with Reagan. And I don't necessarily want you to cover specifics if you're uncomfortable with them. But this is something that's been a nightmare for you. There's an old movie that I think about, the title called To Hell and Back, where victims of crime, a lot of the times in domestic violence situations, go to hell and back several times, and I think that's probably a fair analogy here. Your story has been covered many times in the press. You've been on my program before, but I want to start out with you, Reagan, and talk about the crime itself. What happened?
Basically, what happened was my husband had an extreme anger problem, and he had been violent in the past, but not to a certain degree. It got to the point where I started seeing certain issues in my children reenacting how he acted towards me. I gave him an ultimatum of behaving himself and not being so violent for 7 days, and he wasn't able to do that and ended up handcuffing me, raping me, and beating me. We went through a lot of problems through the court systems, and to the point where I wasn't necessarily getting the help, so a lot of things were confusing, and he ended up going to jail and then getting out of jail and then coming back out and violating an order of protection four times now. So it's been an extreme process, to the fact where I'm not necessarily getting justice in return. It's been nothing but a fight and a struggle.
When you talk about the process, and that's part of what we're going to do this evening, and I'll stick with Reagan here for a minute, the process itself and how it dealt with you as a victim. I've interviewed rape victims many times on my program, and a common thread with all of them is that they felt re-victimized each time that they had to tell their story, give a statement, have a medical treatment, go to court, talk to a defense lawyer, whatever. Is that a safe analogy when I say that you get re-victimized every time you have to talk about this?
Yes, because it's putting you back into that position of exactly what happens, and sometimes I'll just even be staring and not even thinking and reliving the moment and putting myself back into that position. And I try to move on, and then in the drop of a that, it automatically puts me back into that moment.
This isn't about publicity. This is about justice. And Cherry, you're Reagan's mom. We all adhere to the principle when we grow up and when we raise our families that we'll do the best we can, and there are going to be bumps in the road, Cherry, and all of a sudden something like this happens. You grandchildren, you have this nightmare unfold in front of you, and you are not like other victims' families. You didn't sit back and wait to see what happened. You got involved right away, and you took the system to task, so to speak, because it was failing you somewhat. And I want to start with this question, Cherry, for you. Is all of a sudden the first time you heard about what happened to your daughter? A dumb question would be, how would it make you feel? That's obvious. How did you respond to what happened to Cherry, and how have you been working with this?
When I got the call from the hospital that Regan was taken in because she was raped and beaten by John, my husband and I immediately went up there, and I have to tell you, I wasn't all that surprised. He's just one of these guys that you have a real bad feeling about. I always have. And, you know, I think maybe that's what this whole thing has done for me, is now I speak up and say something, and I have to tell you, I have terrible guilt feelings over not doing more when I saw things in the past. I almost feel like I didn't do enough soon enough to help my child when I should have.
You know, when you say, and when I say as a host or as a police officer, try not to blame yourself. It's not your fault. You did nothing wrong. And this question is for Cherry. That's so easier said than done, because we do. We blame ourselves because we saw signs or something happened. But as a parent or a grandparent or whatever, you think, well, you know, they're adults. Maybe they can work it out themselves. We'll just have to keep an eye on this. Did that happen with you?
It did, but I even more so. I had a real uneasy feeling that he was not who he was pretending to be. And of course we had when my grandson fell three stories while he was under his care, and that was a definite hint that there was something wrong. He didn't come to the hospital to visit him. He immediately enclosed the third floor that he fell from. He always acted like a criminal, and I to this day I have flashbacks of him looking at me over over his shoulder, and in a way that it was like, is she buying this?
You know, and the human eye, the human facial expression tells a thousand stories. Stacy Dietrich, the police officer that takes the radio call to handle the rape case, we've done it, I've done it, you've done it many, many times, and we got that kind of that sick feeling in our stomach. Okay, what's this about? Training today compared to training 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago is a lot different. But you're going to roll on this call for the first time. The victim, she's been violated, allegedly. The family, the hospital, the doctor's call. You walk into that emergency room the first time, and I know there's that perspective of the female officer compared to the male officer, but I want to ask you the question as an officer. How do you handle it the first time?
The very first time, you know, as an officer or with that particular victim?
As an officer, that particular victim, you walk into that emergency room. All you've been told is there's an allegation of a rape. You don't know anything more.
Well, you know, the first thing I like to do is make contact with the victim, and I like to do that alone. And, you know, I've had heated exchanges with nurses and doctors and whatnot, but, you know, when I'm in there alone, when I can pull a chair up, lean over the bed, make them feel comfortable, and get them talking without all these, you know, medical personnel and family hovering over them, that's where I tend to get the most information. And for the most part, you know, obviously we like to know immediately, give us a suspect name. And if it does happen to be the husband, I immediately check to see if he's there before I even go any further.
Yep.
Because if he is there, she clearly is not going to go any further in talking to me because she feels intimidated. So at that point, I may call some other officers up there to get him out of the hospital. You know, if there's enough visible injuries that an arrest can be made, at least at that point, before we type up a felony warrant for the sexual assault, so be it. But most importantly, if it is the spouse and they're there, I want to get him out of the hospital.
Victims Advocate Susan Murphy Milano, this is a whirlwind that's happening. All of a sudden, you're in the hospital. Doctors, nurses, police officers. Hell, the guy who did the rape may be standing 25 feet from you. You as the victim, your head is spinning, you're sick, you're feeling guilt, you're blaming yourself, you don't know what to do. A police officer that's worth a salt, or an ER nurse or a doctor, they're going to have someone like you on call that can come in and help out. Now, the ball's in your court, Susan. What do you do when you arrive at that ER?
It depends on who's in the room. If the police officer is there, you know, I try to bond a little bit with the police officer before I walk into the room. I ask everybody that's in there to come out, and I assess the situation. Sometimes the victim, I can't come until later, until after she's out of the hospital, because maybe there's so many things that have to happen, because the police are the first responders who really have to get the guts of the information. I have to assess the danger assessment, because if the offender is there, maybe everybody else is in danger. I can't shoot from the hip and react to what's happened. So if I don't feel that upon arriving it's a good situation for me at the time, I literally say nothing. I may not even enter the room, and I leave. I give my contact information, and then I follow up with it when, usually 72 hours after, because things have calmed down a little bit, everybody's got their information, they're working the case, the prosecutor's working the case, then I move forward. Sometimes I don't move forward for 6 months because of the trauma that's involved, or because the system isn't, all the pieces aren't in place, where the prosecutor hasn't charged the case yet and they're still working the case. I don't get in there sometimes until after. It's very rare I will go in unless there is an attempted murder on a victim that I will go in.
Robin Sachs, ADA out of Los Angeles County. Defense attorneys look for, well, one of the first things they look for, and I'm not a defense attorney, but I've been around them enough to know, they're going to look for screw-ups in a case. They're going to look for a chain of custody issue where somebody was fiddling with evidence, or it wasn't labeled right, or the time is wrong, or somebody wasn't Mirandized, or something. They're going to look for an easy out for their client. As an ADA, you would love to have a file handed to you that all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed, and it's just a perfect case, but that hardly ever happens, does it?
No, it doesn't happen. And just kind of playing off a little bit of what Stacey and Susan are talking about, and what you're talking about in terms of the anatomy of a crime, in terms of how a case is handled, is so critical in how a case is ultimately prosecuted. Cases can be won and lost based on technicalities, but as I train police officers in Los Angeles, really in a sexual assault or a rape case, there are only two defenses. It's either it wasn't me,
yep,
or it was consensual. It's not that difficult to kind of figure out which version it's going to be, and the more that happens at the upfront stage in terms of the investigation, and what Stacey talked about is so critical, that relationship and the key information that's received at the beginning and the height of the moment is what really helps the prosecution in terms of a case. Not just so much talking to the victim and hearing the rendition of the events from the victim's voice, but also the people that accompany the victim, like Stacey said, not only the defendant, but the people who are there, what we call the fresh complaint witnesses. Why is it that this person came in on this particular day to tell? what information, what happened that made it different than any other type of day? And those kinds of moments, that if they can be captured and then preserved in police reports, make all the difference in terms of the successful prosecution of a case, such to the point that you can almost overcome the whatever technical issues may come about. Because even if you have a Miranda violation, or even if you have some other violation, if everything else makes sense, then the prosecution should be able to go forward and be able to prove the case.
The DA, Reagan, says everything makes sense. It's not making sense to you. I'm going to take you back to being in that ER. All of a sudden, I think I'm very accurate when I'm saying you're being swarmed around by people. All hell is breaking loose. Maybe you're blaming yourself. Maybe you're not. You wondered when you took those vows, those wedding vows, you know, this is the right guy for me, I hope. You've got children. You know when things started going wrong. All of a sudden, your worst nightmare has happened. Let's go to you now, Reagan. How are you feeling now that this has happened? The worst of the worst has happened, and you've got all these people talking to you.
Well, I don't necessarily like talking about all of it, but I'm just talking about it to, one, keep me and my children safe, and to also maybe help someone else out there that may not know what to do.
Absolutely.
Other than that, I don't like to talk about it. The only time I actually did talk about it was in therapy, and I felt that was very healthy for me, and it got a lot of information out of me, and it made me understand how severe of a victim I actually was without even knowing that I was, and that it wasn't my fault, and I couldn't change things, and no matter what I did, it was inevitable that he would have done this sooner or later.
When you talk about, and I'm going to go to Cherry. Cherry is Reagan's mom. You're at the emergency room. You're wondering what you can do, what's happened, how can you, you know, your mind is spinning 1,000 miles an hour. You want justice, obviously. But as a parent, any parent, and I don't care who you are, you want to try and protect your child. You know your child has been violated the worst way that a person can be violated, but you don't have all the answers right now. Talk about your emotions, Cherry. I'm sure rage, sickness, disappointment, whatever. How were you feeling? What were your emotions in that ER room?
I became physically ill. I was shaking. I couldn't stop crying. I felt so terrible for my child, and yes, I wanted to physically injure him within an inch of his life, maybe not even that, but it was horrible. But I'll tell you what I did, and I think it's my Christian faith that helped me to do that. I remember God saying, "Put sin likes to hide in the dark." And so I said to my daughter, we put the crime in the light no matter what, and God will take care of the rest. And that's what we've proceeded to do all the way down the line. And it's I think it's the best thing to do to help your child. I don't think doing anything else is going to really help your child.
Helping your child is one thing, Cherry. Protecting them, the kids, the family, the whole atmosphere, even to the point where who's wondering, who's looking, what are the neighbors, the paper, the media, everything's going to get involved. We'll go to Stacy Dietrich, police officer. You're there now. You got to try and sort this out. You're going to get a whole bunch of different stories from different people. Police officers are going to be put on the spot because this case is going to make or break. A big part of it will be because of you and how you handle it. So how do you handle it?
Well, the biggest thing is what does the victim say, and what am I seeing evidentiary-wise? You know, am I seeing visible injuries? What is, you know, that tells you, it tells a story. You know, I've walked in and seen, you know, a bald spot on the top of a woman's head where her hair was literally ripped out. You know, wrist marks where they were held so tightly by the wrist. And it's very difficult, and this is one of the things I see some police officers do. You know, there's been times where I've walked into the emergency room and I'm just barraged by the victim's family. I've even had nurses scream in my face, "This girl's boyfriend raped her. Please tell me he's in jail." And, you know, at that point, I have had no information. And, you know, I'm trying to say, "You need to give me a minute. I need to talk to her. Well, why isn't he in jail?" I mean, literally screaming at me. And sometimes I've seen some officers that, you know, get taken aback by that. "Well, okay, we'll just hold on." And they run out to their car and they get on the radio and they say, "Go to this address, put him in custody." And then they go back and talk to the victim and they get a completely different story. And maybe it was the ex-boyfriend's friend, and just completely has thrown the whole case. Just to jump like that at the drop of a hat, instead of taking that extra minute to just say, "Look, this is my job. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to do my job right so that this, you know, like Robin said, we can go from point A to point Z and there's no mistakes in between."
And that's so important. This is The Anatomy of a Crime on the Dana Pritzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pritzer.
All right, we're back. We're discussing the anatomy of a crime tonight. We have the victim of a horrific domestic violence incident, rape. You name it, Reagan, Mom Cherry, police officer Stacy Dietrich, DA Robin Sachs, and violence expert, violence advocate Susan Murphy Milano. We're at the point now where the crimes happen. We're at the initial stages of the investigation in the ER room. Robin, the physical aspect has to start now. Robin Sachs, ADA, the evidence, the physical evidence in any case is so important. You can have a he said, she said case. You may have a cooperating witness, but that physical evidence, that rape kit, DNA, swabs, you name it, is so important, and it has to be done right. But yet when you hear these cases, see them, or participate in them as an investigator, they are so intrusive. They are so bloody awful, for lack of a better term. I'd like to get your take as a DA.
Well, the first thing is in terms of scientific and medical evidence is a wonderful thing. And don't get me wrong, I think having DNA is a fantastic, it's one less thing to have to deal with in terms of knowing whether or not, you know, the actual act occurred. But the one issue that we do have that I think that some people don't really realize is scientific evidence does not tell us whether or not a particular act was consensual or not.
Right.
So, you know, if there's DNA and semen and it's a spousal rape situation, it doesn't say whether or not that was a consensual sexual encounter. All it says is that the sex occurred. So that doesn't corroborate the crime necessarily. It corroborates the act. So, yes, if there is a faulty DNA and there is DNA that's improperly collected or scientific evidence, but what it does is it puts importance on some of the other evidence that's often overlooked. I see police officers and victims and people say all the time, "But there's DNA and there's DNA and there's DNA," and that's great. But DNA and then coupled with a great report that shows injuries, that shows bruises, that shows marks around the neck, that shows slap marks, that show, you know, good reports that show cell phones were broken or items in the house were broken, other evidence that corroborates not just the crime, but what occurred surrounding the crime to make your theory of the proof is critical in terms of the prosecution of a case.
Stacy Dietrich, police officer, we're at the initial stages. You see that you've got a good case or a good lead. You know who's responsible. You go out, you make your arrest. You've got the perp. He's cuffed up. You've Mirandized him. You got to sit down and take a statement. You're working in a department where the detectives aren't taking over. You're actually going right from A to Z on this case. You can't let your emotions get involved in you, but you're talking about a horrific rape, sodomy, violence, terrible things. It's tough for the cop to put away his human side and be able to deal with this. objectively and do it right, because if your emotions get involved, that could ruin things, could it not?
Right, and for some reason, I don't experience that when I'm doing the interviews. Now, I will tell you that if I am, you know, doing an interrogation with a rape suspect and he clearly is not responding to me because I am a female, I will immediately get up and walk out and get somebody else to take over.
Right.
Because, you know, there's just it's beating your head against the wall. You know, before I even make the arrest and have to Mirandize them, wherever I'm at with them, I'll, you know, kind of beat around the bush. You know, hey, what are you doing? We kind of got this complaint. You know, do you know what that's all about? And it's surprisingly enough, some of the stupid statements that they make prior to an arrest, which, of course, you know, can be added to the report. And, you know, once we get them in, I guess I don't get upset, because I have always looked at it as they're in handcuffs, they're off the street at this point. I am going to do whatever it takes to get a confession, and that's one of my stronger points is interview and interrogation. And if I have to have them in there for 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever I have to do, or how much I have to make nice to these people to ultimately get that confession and get that case solid, get them locked up, it's to me, it's well worth it. And I'll see, you know, other officers, specifically males, that actually, and I see this more with sex offenders, that just cannot even be in the room. They're so upset and angry. They can't do the interview. They're hacked off, and they just said, I can't do this. I want to kill this guy.
Right. You know, and it's that whole emotion thing, and being an officer and having be able to put aside those emotions. Reagan, the victim, and your interaction with the police, did the police do their job in your case properly?
When they came to the hospital, I believe so, because they came in, they were very sincere, and they did talk to me and actually kind of give me an example that he was leaving because he had to go to a crime scene where the husband shot 5 of the family members. I mean, he made it very real to me that this could have been more serious than I could be dead. Everything was so surreal to me at the time, and I was still trying to absorb everything that had happened to me and that it wasn't a dream, and I was awake. But the way they approached it and had me sign off on everything, I think it was all correct there at the hospital scene. And then they went ahead and they went and arrested him. However, the police department that arrested him, you know, I don't necessarily know how that all went down, but they didn't allow my children to leave with my sister. They made my children stay with his sister, which until I was released from the hospital, then I could go pick them up.
Cherry, as mom, you're wanting, like you said before, you talked about emotions. When the police come to you, I'm sure the first question you're going to ask the police is, that SOB in jail? Has he been arrested? Has he been whatever? Share with us your recollection and dealings with the police.
Well, I honestly, in Regan's case, it was extremely easy. He confessed, and they found handcuffs. There's a bloody mattress. There's blood all over the floor, all over the wall, broken window. She was all battered and bruised. She had terrible bruises on her wrist from where the handcuffs were. She had, you know, vaginal tearing. He made it easy. He confessed. He didn't think that there was anything wrong with what he did. She was his wife.
You know, the mentality, and we can talk about the cycle of violence, Susan Murphy Milano, and all that. And some would say that that's psychobabble. It doesn't make sense. But all you have to do is be involved in one case, and you'll see how the cycle of violence is so true and so accurate. Whatever shape you want to make it, or however it is, there is certainly that cycle. And then you get that machismo from the accused that he thought he had to write. You get that terror in the victim. who thought that she may have caused this or may have been part of this, and you come in to try and sort it out and do what you can to keep people so they stay on track so they don't fall off the rails, it's got to be terribly difficult.
It is. I think first and foremost, it begins with gaining the trust of the victim, which is often very difficult to do. If prosecutors have, someone like Robin has a difficulty in that, a police officer has a difficulty in that, and you know, I'm sort of the third spoke on the wheel in a way, and the difficulty in getting the victim to trust you to say, this is what's going to happen, to explain the court process, to explain, you know, the officer at this point is out of the process until maybe they have to come and testify to the evidence or when, you know, that they took this information down the police report. The prosecutor, however, though, is such an important part in all of this. And so if I can't communicate accurately with the prosecutor and also gain their trust, and I'm not, you know, there to do anything but help their case and get a conviction and get the person put away. But first and foremost, it's the trust of the victim, because they don't know who to trust or where to go or what to do. You know, they've been kind of bombarded, and they're still being re-victimized in a way each time they have to tell their story over and over. And then there's the children, and they have to be strong. Sometimes, in a lot of these cases, Regan didn't do this, but they want to give up. They want to stop, because the children are reenacting the violence by fighting, by doing things, or by being fearful, by calling out in the middle of the night, by not being able to sleep. And in this case, Regan did, you know, she went above and beyond to secure her children. Sometimes a victim is so victimized that they can't do that, and they're not able to help themselves, much less anybody else. So here's a victim in a situation with children. She has to go on with her life. She has to go to work. How does she do that? What support systems can a victim's advocate put in place? And what is specific for that victim? Because, as I've said many times, no two cases are the same, just like your DNA. The victims are going to react or not react in a very different way in each case.
Robin Sachs, ADA, we have our arrest, we have the evidence gathered, you have a family, the victims who are wanting justice. You get this case along with the 15 other cases that you're prosecuting at the same time. You're human. You want everything to be done right. You're going to trial, or all of a sudden there's a plea bargain is offered by a defense attorney. There's all sorts of different parameters that can be looked at. We only have 50 minutes here, and we're already, you know, at 21 minutes. We could do a week show just on the court process itself, but in the Reagan's case, this is a case where the system did fail. Orders of protection that weren't followed, rearrests, sentencing that hasn't even happened yet, but they look at the victim, and I talked about this re-victimization. How do you as a DA try not to re-victimize the victim each and every time that you've got to put them on the stand?
Well, there's, as you said, so many different, we can spend hours and hours and hours on this issue in terms of plea bargaining and then also not re-victimizing the victim, which are two separate issues. Plea bargaining in Los Angeles and in California, which is really supposed to be how it is done throughout the whole country, is really an offer that is supposed to come by way of the prosecution, not as an offer necessarily by the defense, but an offer to the prosecution. And basically, the analysis is supposed to be, or at least it is for me, is, okay, these are the charges that I have filed. These are the charges that I feel that I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. But as you and I have spoken many, many, many times before, jurors are our voters and our drivers, and they're regular folks, and you need a unanimous jury to convict. And whenever there's a sexual assault or a domestic violence or anything like that, all of a sudden cases become not about the assault, and they become about the dirty laundry of one victim or another, and it kind of becomes a mini trial within another. And knowing that, there is the aspect that as a prosecutor, we want to say, okay, what is going to be best for the victim at the end of the day? Because to me, if there is a case where a victim ends up, you end up in a trial and you go through it and they are put on the stands and they're cross-examined and they're asked questions and their kids are asked questions and their family members are asked questions, and then a jury comes back not guilty, there's nothing more devastating in terms of that. It literally sends a message to the defendant, I got away with it. I can do this again to this victim, to other victims, and it's quite a scary burden to carry. So as a prosecutor, that's one aspect that we're keeping in mind. And then what we're doing is saying, okay, with the charges that we have charged, if the jury were to come back guilty and convict him, what would the judge likely do in terms of the disposition in that case? What would the judge sentence on? And in a plea bargain, the model is supposed to be, okay, well, if the judge is going to give 10 years on a sentence, then we're going to offer something that's a hair better, a tiny bit different, that would encourage the defendant to be able to plead and still secure the conviction and have adequate rope against him to be able to come back. It doesn't mean that it's always followed in every case. It doesn't mean that people don't give away cases that shouldn't have been given away. But sometimes, and one of the aspects that is not talked about as much as you hear about the injustice in the system in terms of people getting away with sentences, sometimes you have to ask, is this a case that would have been filed? And sometimes there are cases that are close calls in terms of, should we file it or not? And if a case is filed and we end up with a conviction by a plea, even though it may not seem like the sentence should be what it is, it's a win to have the plea anyway. So there's a lot of aspects. I know this is where the system is kind of rubs against the different goals of the different people. You know, what you hear in the news and what the victims feel and what our passions are one thing, but then the reality is the court come in play and you have all those little pesky constitutional laws that dictate what happened, and that can really change the face of what would be a just sentence.
And when we come back, we're going to talk about the court process with the victim's mother, and a police officer that may have to testify in the system. We're calling this The Anatomy of a Crime. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show, and we're going to finish up our segment on the anatomy of a crime. We have the victim, Reagan, her mom, Cherry, the police officer, Stacy, the DA, Robin, and the victim's advocate, Susan. I was going to say now we've got to trial a year and a half later, 2 years later. That's one of the things in the system that's terribly flawed, but whatever. Reagan, you're gone to trial now. You've told this story 1,015 times. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it must seem like that to you. All of a sudden, you're on the stand. Your husband or ex has been on conditions not to contact you. He's contacted you. He has, and I'm using these terms, terrorized you. You're back to, I don't know if you remember or not, me saying going to hell and back. Now you've gone and you're back and you're gone and you're back and you're gone and back. All of a sudden, here you are. It's trial time. This is make it or break it. How was that for you?
Well, when I was originally on trial, it was very hard because they said, you know, a lot of issues on the stand that weren't necessarily true, and trying to break down my character and justify why he did what he did, without even proclaiming that, you know, he raped me. He basically went around the truth and tried to do everything in his power, and which he told me when he called me on the phone, he told me that that's his attorney's job, and that if he told him everything that he did, then, you know, they would throw the book at him. So basically, he was just sitting up there terrorizing me and asking me questions that I fully couldn't answer, and the DA wasn't rebuttaling and allowing me to answer the question. So basically, they were getting what they wanted to hear, and I wasn't being able to actually tell my side of the story.
Robin Sachs, my last question for you, ADA out of Los Angeles County. I'm going to go after the DA a little bit here. Nothing personal. We're innocent until proven guilty. That's the accused. But the victim, is being re-victimized on the stand by the defense attorney. She's being interrupted. She's not being allowed to answer questions a certain way because it may be hearsay, it may not be. There's objections. There's all sorts of things. This person, this young mother, who's never been involved in the court system before, is all of a sudden thrust into it thinking, holy crap, who's the bad guy here? You as the DA can only do so much. How do you handle that?
Well, it's very frustrating to go through the process and watch a victim being re-victimized, and actually, for that matter, seeing a police officer being on the stand and torn apart over something that you know you have the evidence and you know in your heart and soul you believe in, and you know that the family, the victim, are depending on you to make everything come together. It's heartbreaking. But the one thing that I can say is it's actually almost better when the defense attorneys are such jerks and when the defense attorneys are doing that, because the time that I find cases that really go south, it's an interesting phenomenon that happens, is when the defense attorney uses the kindness, uses the trying to befriend the victim, where the guards then go down and then they literally get taken advantage of in front of your very eyes, and you can see the vulnerability and the control that happens that way. So even though it feels awful through those moments of objections and fighting and arguments and that kind of stuff, the one thing that's nice is that by having those moments, the victim keeps focused and is remembering and knowing what could possibly happen, as opposed to being tricked into answering questions and only being pointed out later on how a question could have hurt them.
Robin, I know you have to go. I'll let you go. I appreciate you joining us this evening, and I'll see you a little bit later on Justice Interrupted, where you'll interrogate me on the stand.
Love doing that. Thank you, guys.
All right. Okay, let's go now to Susan Murphy Milano. You have to, part of your job as the victim's advocate, as the violence expert, you're going to try and, I'll use the term court prep. You're trying to get your client ready for what's going to happen. There's no more intimidating place on earth than maybe besides the rape kit that happens or the violent act that happens itself, than having to step into that courtroom, having to step up on that stand. Yeah, you swear an oath, but all of a sudden all the eyes in the courtroom are on you and you want to do what's right. How do you get somebody ready for that?
Well, you tell them, as in Regan's case, you know, this is what's going to happen in the courtroom. This is what the judge is going to do. This is what the defense attorney is going to do. Particularly the defense attorney, you can't be bothered by the remarks of what's going to be said, because they're not true, but you're not going to be able to stand up and shout no matter what. It's also as important as it can be, in my opinion, that the victim be in the courtroom. Because you have to know that if it's retried or there's more charges, it's not about sitting there and being re-victimized. It's about sitting there and, you know, you're at the end of the process and understanding the process, understanding the DA or the prosecutor or the state's attorney, wherever you live in your state, understanding all the components of what people are going to say, what people are going to do. When a remark is made, you know, you can't react to the remark. Just sit there and try to remain as calm as possible. A lot of times it's sitting next while the process begins and saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. Don't react. Because, you know, they're saying terrible things. The defense attorney is really re-victimizing the victim by trying to throw anything up on the wall that's going to stick. It's not true,
yeah,
but that's what they're going to do. And for the victim, It's heart-wrenching for me to sit there with that. And so I have to sort of anticipate every single process that there's going to be. And that also includes the offender's family maybe coming up to her, talking to her,
yep,
immediately knowing when to jump out of the courtroom and exit gracefully.
Stacey Dietrich, you're the police officer. 26 years for me in the job. I still get butterflies when I go to court. I don't have a problem testifying, but I've seen officers physically get ill before they have to go in because they know that a big part of the case is on them. I learned a long time ago that you can't count on what's going to happen in court. You just do your job and you go there. But I'm curious your perspective on a case like this. How do you handle it when you know some knives are going to be thrown at you?
Well, you know, Robin touched on a good point about the defense attorney that plays nice. You know, I've had attorneys literally up there in my face screaming like I'm some Barney Fife from 1950. And, you know, I've always prided myself in my testimony as far as not getting rattled. When I'm asked a question, I always pause before I answer. If I think an objection's in order, I'll glance at the prosecution's table. Hopefully they get the hint. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Right.
And the biggest thing I see with cops, when they get rattled and they, when you don't know, if I don't know, I say, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. If I don't remember, I'm sorry, I don't remember that. It's not a crime to say that.
No.
And, you know, especially with the rookies, you know, they get up there, well, you know, they get so mad and they try to justify it instead of simply saying, I don't recall. Because once you say that, it kiboshes anything that they're saying and they move on. And as long as you, you know, keep your composure, keep a decent tone of voice, and look like a professional, that really impacts the jury.
I tell young officers all
right
the time. I tell young officers all the time that you can show just how much you don't know by trying to show how much you
exactly.
do know on the stand, and that can ruin a case real fast. Reagan, the court system, did it fail you or did it do its job?
I believe it failed me. It's like a car without an engine. It's sitting there and you have to either stand behind it and push it because
that's,
it's not working.
That's a good analogy. I never thought of that. It's there, but it's just not doing anything. It's turning itself over and over again. Your case, or this case, some protection order sentencing was going to be done in December, but you are still in fear for your life and your family, are you not?
Yes, I am.
How will you continue on? You have the strength of a wonderful mother and a family and children and people who support you, and many of us are here listening tonight or talking to you, but I am amazed at your inner strength. How do you cope?
Well, I have three kids, and I really don't have a choice. God brought them into this world, and they didn't ask to be treated like this, and the only job I have to do is try to be the best mother that I can be and provide them with a safe and happy environment. And that is the number one priority in my life, and that is what keeps me going.
Cherry, has the system failed your daughter?
I think that's an obvious... I think there's an obvious answer to that. And yes, I mean, I was shocked. I had no idea that this is the shape of the system. The first thing I thought of when this all happened was, wait, this is America. It's not Aruba. And
right.
Will County is a lot like Aruba.
Yeah. No, that's...
any accident, Drew Peterson is there.
Yeah. No, that is so well said. That is so well said. Susan Murphy Milano, you've worked with this family. You can understand, I can understand why they think the system has failed them. Will the system ever be able to make this up to them?
Oh, absolutely not. And I think it began with a mother who was insistent on seeing that justice was done for her daughter. The support system, what she did over the internet, how she just was a pit bull. Who grabbed onto my underwear and wouldn't let go, basically, and looked and brought the case, and it was based on the facts, and so that was the easy part. But the difficult part was literally putting the pieces together of the case and seeing what was missing, what had to be done, what additional charges had to be made. Perhaps the state's attorney's office in this case seemed to be overburdened, so they weren't having to make or take the time or couldn't proceed with certain things that got Regan to this point, which is then the next court date of December 18th. But it's, you know, it's Regan, it's the children, it's her mother. It's having that strong support system that I don't often see. But I often see the tragedy of this, and Regan is one of the few people who has made it and survived it alive, and that has a lot to do with what was done within the system, but it, in particular, has to do with her mother, in my opinion.
I agree. Stacy, Regan, Susan, Cherry, Robin, all of you involved, thank you. I thought that we'd sit down and figure out the anatomy of a crime. We figured out the pieces of it, but that puzzle is still open, and it needs some work to get it into a nice, good package, but we'll keep plugging away. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dana.
Okay, talk soon. Bye-bye.
Ta-da.
Okay, now what we're going to do is cover a couple more stories tonight. One is our old friend Joran van der Sloot. Like most snakes and lizards, he has crawled out from under his rock again, and I sat down with Jossie Manster, the managing editor of Diario, to find out just what's happening with Joran. Did I say Joran or Urine? I'm not sure what I said, but you know what I'm talking about, Joran van der Sloot. And then we're going to go to a gal. Her name is Glendine Grant. And we're going to talk about her daughter who's missing and how she may be a victim of human trafficking. Joran van der Sloot is trafficking young Thai girls. We've seen it on video. Well, we're going to talk to someone whose daughter may be a victim of something similar. And that's a little bit later on. And then, of course, we're going to get updates from the Kaylee Anthony case with bounty hunter Leonard Padilla and Mark Williams, who are both regulars on the Nancy Grace Show. We'll be back in just a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. It's always a pleasure to have Jossie Manster here. Of course, you know Jossie is the managing editor of Diario. He and I did many, many shows on the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Of course, Natalie Holloway is the Alabama teenager that went missing in Aruba over 3 years ago now. And Joran van der Sloot and the Kelpo brothers, of course, as suspects. Joran van der Sloot is back in the media again, showing the, I guess I'm going to say, the normal side of himself. Now trying to lure young girls into prostitution. Hi, Jossie. How are you?
Pretty good.
Tell us about what's been going on with Joran van der Sloot. Of course, we've seen the news reports, but we'd like to get it from the best source, and that's you.
Thank you. What we know is that the police set up Joran van der Sloot for a second time, that he caught him on camera making some kind of deals for $15,000 with young Thai students to sell them into the sex industry in Europe. We know that once that show aired in Holland, the Thai authorities were interested in getting copies of the program, and that made Joran very nervous, and he suddenly disappeared. And he's been disappeared ever since. Nobody knows anything about him, where he is, or what he's doing now.
You and I have talked about him many times, and it seems like he, like snakes we know, like to crawl back under their rocks when the heat gets on. So he's in hiding again, is he?
He is in hiding again, yes. And last time they told us that he had checked into some kind of psychiatric ward, right, which wasn't true. It was just a cover-up for him to remain disappeared. I know from other sources that he intended to go to either Australia or New Zealand, but had problems with the visa, and then he finally ended up in Thailand.
And my audience all know, or at least if they don't, that Peter R. DeVries did the undercover operation here a while back, where Joran all but, well, I guess he did admit to being complicit in the death of Natalie Holloway. However, unfortunately, the Aruban prosecutor decided that there was not enough to proceed with charges. However, I'm seeing our news report fresh off the wire today saying that there is a new witness, a female, that has come forward to say that Joran admitted to her to dumping Natalie's body. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, what they are referring to as, it's not necessarily a new witness. Well, it is a new witness, an old girlfriend of Joran van der Sloot, who was interviewed and on the program with Peter de Vries, the second time. And her name is Celeste, or Celeste, or however you want to pronounce it. And that she said that Joran did admit to her that he was present when Natalie died, and that her body was dumped into the ocean, and that he went with her once on the beach. They were lying on the beach exactly by the fisherman's huts, and that Joran turned around and just told her point blank How would you like to disappear like Natalie disappeared? Or something to that effect. In other words, directly or indirectly, again admitting that he knows exactly what happened to Natalie because he was there. He was probably involved by himself or with some other people. And that her body was dumped into the ocean. And he admitted to that in the first show by Peter DeVries. And it was reconfirmed by this new witness, if you want to call her that, Celeste, that came out on the second show of DeVries and pointed out what Joran confessed to her about 2 years ago here in Aruba.
Now, if you're just tuning in, Jossie Manster is here, is the managing editor of Diario, and we're getting an update on Joran van der Sloot and the investigation into the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Jossie, what is the prosecutor Hans Moss saying with all this new evidence or old evidence that's resurfacing?
Well, you know, to begin with, I have absolutely no confidence in Mr. Moss. I don't think he came down to Aruba to solve this case. He may have come for other purposes with this case. But anyway, that's a personal opinion. What he is claiming, what he is holding himself to is that the prosecution will remain on this case until the end of the year. And by the end of the year, they will make a decision, a definite decision, to either take the case to court or close it forever.
And with Joran hiding under a rock somewhere, that may make it more interesting. Jossie, one last question. You mentioned earlier that the Thai police have requested copies of the DeVries program. Has there been any correspondence between the Thai police and Aruban authorities to find out more about Joran and any other involvement that he's had, say, in Aruba?
No, that I know of, none whatsoever. No, if they had any contact, it would be with the Dutch authorities and not with the Aruban authorities directly. Because all this that is happening with this Thai effect and this new new feat of Joran trying to sell prostitutes to Europe, this all came out in the DeVries' program. So they were looking for copies of the program that DeVries showed in Holland on that memorable Sunday.
And we all have to wonder, Jossie, just what we don't know about this Joran van der Sloot. Every time he turns around, there's more disgusting information about him. It will be interesting to see what happens in the near future. Jossie, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Jossie Manster, managing editor of Diario. It's always a pleasure to have him on the program. And yeah, Joran van der Sloot, just like that snake or that lizard, just when they get exposed to the sun a little bit, they go back and crawl under their rock. Well, if you're trying to solicit girls into prostitution, you're admitting to being part of the death of a young girl, and the prosecutor doesn't want to do anything about it. You got to wonder, and we've talked about that many times, about that system. But justice is served in many ways, and this story is far from being over. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. And what I thought I would do is follow up that story about Joran van der Sloot and how he's involved not only with the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, but now into human trafficking regarding trying to bring young Thai girls into prostitution, with a case that may be involved with human trafficking. It's in regards to the disappearance of Jessica Edith Louise Foster. We've covered this story before, and I encourage you to go to www.jessiefoster.ca. Jesse is J-E-S-S-I-E Foster, F-O-S-T-E-R, that's all one word, .ca. A missing person who may have been taken and put into a human trafficking ring. And on the phone with me is her mother, Glendine Grant. Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've covered this story before, and sadly, I'm only one host, and we need to cover these stories more and more and more. But it takes a case like van der Sloot, the snake that he is, to be caught on tape trying to get these young Thai girls into prostitution. That's human trafficking. He is a high-profile guy. And people, when they hear that human trafficking story, they say, we don't believe it. But it's real. It's happening. It's out there. Tell us about your daughter, Jessica Foster, and how you may think that she is part of a international human trafficking ring.
Well, Jessie went missing over 2.5 years ago. She, in the spring, early spring of 2005, she was taken on what we thought was just a trip down to Fort Lauderdale. She came back after a few days and then was taken on a second trip. This time she went down to Manhattan and to Atlantic City. And before she was to come home, she ended up in Las Vegas. She was supposed to be coming home. I got a call saying, "No, Mom, I'm going to Las Vegas. I'll call you when I get there." She called me when she got there. It was exactly 2 weeks before her birthday. She was going to be turning 21 on May 27th. It was the 14th or the 13th of May. And she said, "I'm going to stay here for my birthday." And I don't know whatever possessed me to say it, and it actually bothers me now that I did, but I said to her, "Jesse, you're not staying in Las Vegas. I know nothing about anything down there. If anything was to happen to you," I even said to her, "if you were ever to go missing, I wouldn't know where to start looking for you."
Oh, my God.
She gave me a phone number of a friend, and she ended up staying there, and 10 months later, she was missing.
Now,
and, you know, we had no idea what was happening in Jesse's life down there. Oh, you know, we thought she was engaged. By the time she went missing, we had thought she had been engaged and living with a wealthy man who was like a trust fund baby. Him and his twin brother got money from their parents, is what we were told, and her fiance was also a race car driver. But we find out after Jesse went missing that Jesse had been hospitalized from beatings, that Jesse had been arrested for prostitution, that Jesse's boyfriend, the fiance, was not a trust fund baby, but he was in fact a pimp. And we know this for a fact. We've got this from the police. Every woman that's ever been connected to him has been also connected to prostitution. At least one of them that I've talked to was not doing it willingly. She's actually we're in contact all the time, but she won't contact the police on Jesse's behalf, and I know she feels terrible about it, but she's just as afraid for herself as we probably now know Jesse was for herself. It's absolutely ridiculous that this happens. I mean, you know, we didn't know anything about Jesse being forced to do what they had her doing. She was working for an escort agency. I talked to the owner of the escort agency after Jesse went missing.
Mm-hmm.
This woman was in tears throughout our whole conversation. You know, she had become close to Jesse. She had tried to convince Jesse to leave. She told me, "I don't ever want you to think that Jesse was like any of the other girls that I've ever known. I took Jesse under my wing. I always felt her special. My nickname to her was Little Girl. I used to tell her, 'Little girl, go home.' And she used to tell me, 'I'm afraid.' And she would show her the bruises, and you know, everybody was afraid of this guy. And, you know, she was actually giving me my condolences because she and everyone that knew Jesse actually, when this first happened, thought that Jesse was dead. And I think that it wasn't until after talking to me that they thought there was maybe another explanation. They actually thought maybe Jesse was taken somewhere, which, as you said, is human trafficking.
Absolutely.
Somebody somewhere against their will, or even, you know, with their permission, only when they get there, not letting them leave. Those are still forms of human trafficking.
Yeah, they're kidnapped, they're captured, they're whatever. They're lured into...
They're drugged.
Yep. They're lured into a life that either willingly or not they get into, but once they get into it, they find out that it's a nightmare. It's ran by organized crime, drug dealers, pimps, you name it.
They see what happens to the ones that don't listen. They're probably told so many horror stories by the time that they're so brainwashed that they're just afraid. I mean, I honestly tell you that you know, I'm really close to my children. I've got four daughters. Jessie's the second oldest of four girls. My girls are close with each other, too. And though we didn't know what exactly was happening to Jesse down there, Jesse knew what was happening to her. And the way I say that is because Jesse was in constant communication with her friends and her family. And not just, you know, by calling us, you know, every Sunday. She would call every day, and she would talk to either me or one of her sisters or her stepmom, her dad, friends. And every, you know, over and over and over all day long, she would talk to numerous people. And sometimes it was text messaging, and sometimes it was voicemails because you missed a call, or she'd drop an email, or you'd talk to her on the phone, you name it. And so when Jesse's communication stopped, we actually became aware of it within one day because of how close the communication was. And the way it had happened was she had talked to her sister on the 28th of March in 2006, and they were planning a meeting here in Kamloops. Crystal was working in Alberta, and Jesse was down in Las Vegas, and they were planning a meeting here in Kamloops where Jesse's car has been parked in my backyard, and they were going to drive her car to Calgary for their stepsister's wedding reception. Their stepsister was getting married in Mexico, and the reception was in Calgary in the middle of April, and so they had these plans. I know for a fact that Jesse was really planning to do this because we got a card in the mail that we opened up after she went missing. It was from her car insurance company in Calgary, and it was the card for 1 month's worth of insurance that she had paid over $200 for when she came here. And she had, they had taken her credit card payment and sent her the card so that she could drive her car back to Calgary and have insurance. So you're not going to do that if you're planning on, not coming back or, taking off or something. So, there was a lot of signs that just told us that whatever happened to Jesse was not part of what Jesse's plan was. When Jesse went missing and we couldn't get a hold of anybody, it was days before we finally, it was the 9th of April before we were finally able to contact somebody that, was able to help us. And that was because it took us that long to get Peter Todd to answer his phone. I left messages and phoned him, and I just wasn't really thinking in that, he had anything to do with it, or that he would purposely be avoiding my calls. Until my friend said to me, you know what, I would just be call blocking my number and phoning him.
Right.
Because, I was just phoning him and leaving messages. And I thought, well, but that, that doesn't make sense. But I did it. And he answered.
This is such a sad story, Glendine. Oh. And it's heartbreaking. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to remind the listeners to go to the webpage www.jessefoster.ca. Of course, it's on the show notes to learn more about this case.
I'm not sure if you knew this, but her story was shown on America's Most Wanted last Saturday.
Right. Yes. Absolutely.
Briefly, and I don't agree with the subject that it was under, but that's okay. It got her on the show, and with the promise of a future show. Because this one was actually, in connection with some other girls that were missing but had been found deceased. And, the stories just don't add up. And my biggest difference that I just beg them to take note of is all of Jesse's stuff went missing with her. And if somebody had, killed Jesse, perhaps like these other girls, and they're assuming it was a serial killer, it would have been impossible for her belongings to have gone missing.
Exactly. No, and I agree with you. That's a big part of this, and we need to cover these stories more than we have been. Glendine, if you had a way to get a message to Jesse, to Jessica, or someone who may know where she is, what would that message be?
Well, if it was to Jesse, I would just say, hang on, baby, because we're going to find you, and we haven't even stopped for a minute in all this time. And you know how much I love her. She knows that. I know that she doesn't doubt it. And I have my biggest fear is how much she's worrying about us, worrying about her rather than taking care of herself as well as she can. And if it's to somebody who knows where she is and they know what's happening to her and they're not doing anything, and if it's out of fear, they can do it anonymously. And there's a reward. We've got a $50,000 reward that may help them get away from anything that they might be afraid of. But all I want is for somebody just to help us find Jessie and bring her home. And if Jessie's not alive, she needs to come home just as desperately. I believe she is with all my heart. But if she's not, she'll still be coming home. And, we just need her to come back. So many things have happened. She's got, her sisters are having kids. They're all, they're growing up and their life is beginning as adults. And she needs to come home because it's not the same,
Well, we need to get Jesse home and get justice for Jesse, that's for sure.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Glendine.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
a sad story for sure. And we're going to finish up tonight with some updates on the Kaylee Anthony case. There's been so much that has gone on in the last 4 or 5 days, week, whatever it's been. It's almost, if I had some circus music queued up, you know, the da 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 da, you know, that, and I'm not making light of it, but I guess I am. That music would be apropos for what's been going on with this case. I thought I'd sit down with two people involved in it, both knowledgeable as far as what's been going on. Leonard Padilla, bounty hunter, who has been kicked through the mud here the last little while, including by me, and Mark Williams. He's a news director of a radio station down in the Orlando area. We'll start out with Mark and see what he has to say about the Anthony case. Okay, we're back. Mark Williams is here with an update also on the Kaylee Anthony case. Mark, how are you?
I'm just doing great, Dana. How are things up there?
Oh, things are fine. It's cold, it's miserable, but a story that's heating up always is the Kaylee Anthony case. And, you know, I know Tim Miller, I know Leonard Padilla, and it had to... Well, I did. It made me sick seeing the antics that went on, whether it was media spin or just what happened. I've said it many times on my program. I don't care if it's Elvis or Mickey Mouse in short pants. Someone needs to find Kaylee Anthony, and that's what this is all about. Your thoughts about what's been going on since I had you on last?
Well, you know, you talked about Leonard Padilla and, of course, Tim Miller, and there seems to be a squabble there. I stay quite neutral. Because I know Leonard, I do not know Tim, but Leonard has been on the set with me on several occasions on the Nancy Grace show. You know, it's interesting to see what goes on. It does come down to finding Kaylee, whether alive or dead.
Yep.
But that's the main goal in life, and these guys have got to get together and do it if they want to do it. I thought this thing would have ended last week when Leonard held a prayer vigil on the banks of the Little Econ River here in the Orlando area, but it didn't go away. You know, he got some divers and he put them in the water.
I just interviewed Leonard Padilla, and I told him on the phone and during the interview, I've taken some swipes at him because I have to look at how this is done. He's a media guy. I understand that.
Yeah.
And if I had my way, I can't believe this because I actually host a show, I wish the media would all go away. This would go to court and let the judges decide, but that's not going to be how it happens. What annoyed me somewhat is how this was covered, not only, well, I'm going to say across board, and in fact, there's a... amateur blogger, I guess you'd call it, who's running around with a video camera in Orlando, who seems to be beating some of the news organizations to the scoop. And I think that's part of what got Leonard into a bit of a jackpot and had some mud kicked at him.
You know, Dana, that could be the case because I'm not aware of this video blogger because I've not seen his work. And me being a straight news guy, I take what bloggers have with kind of a grain of salt because sometimes they just put things on the internet without checking them out.
And we need to verify. What did Reagan say? Verify, verify, verify. I don't know if my audience is too old or too young to remember who Ronald Reagan is, but when it comes down to credibility, and there's a blog associated to my show, and there's a blog associated to your radio station, and everyone has a blog. That's today. But when you look at it, now we're seeing a story about one of the Blackwater divers who allegedly lied about his military service and had to resign from the Orange County Sheriff's Office. We're hearing about Leonard Padilla being asked to take a polygraph test. We all sit back and say, okay, Leonard takes one. How about George, Cindy, Casey, and Lee Anthony?
Well, and here's the deal on that. Todd Bosinski was one of the scuba divers for a volunteer organization that works out of nearby Apopka, which is just north of Orlando. Apparently, he was booted out of the Orange County Sheriff's Office only a couple of months into his training duty because he allegedly had lied about him being in the war theater in Iraq. But Leonard doesn't care who it is. He just wants to find whatever is left of Kaylee, or just find Kaylee alive. Take your pick. But that's been the latest dust-up in this neck of the woods. It's going to be interesting to see what really happens in this case. This thing has gained so much media attention, and I'm not just talking about domestically, even in Canada and Mexico. I'm talking about internationally,
yep.
Where a friend of mine said he saw me in a bar on TV in Singapore. So that's how many legs this thing has.
Wow. You know, and not making light of this, but I'm sure you've been seen in bars, but maybe not just on TV, Mark.
No, just TV.
Listen, I appreciate your time, and I wish all the infighting would just disappear. I know that's easier said than done, and we all concentrate on finding Kaylee, and this story will come to a head, and we'll get some resolve eventually, but not this way. I don't like it. It's given me a sour taste in my stomach. Thank you, Mark.
Okay, Dana, take care.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
That's Mark Williams, and you'll know him from his regular appearances on The Nancy Grace Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back with an update on the search for Kaylee Anthony. I have bounty hunter Leonard Padilla. Leonard's been kicked around here lately. I'm sure he's no stranger to that, and it's probably not bothering him all that much, but I thought I'd bring him on to show to see what he has to say. Leonard, how are you?
Fine. How's it going?
That's good. It's good. You know, you and I have talked before, and you've been criticized a lot here lately in the media. In fact, even I've thrown a couple of punches at you, but you are a big guy. You can handle it. What's going on with you and the search for Kaylee Anthony?
Okay. As of last Friday, we had discussed that it would have to be a much bigger effort. After we talked to some alligator people and to some flood control people that told us how the river flowed and things of that nature and what the waters had been like, and that if the body had been thrown in right there across from the swings, that the alligators wouldn't eat the black bag that it would possibly be in, or plastic. However, they would eat bones and things of that nature, so it would be very difficult in that silt to find anybody unless we had an extensive search going. And it would cost a lot of money because you can't expect... The guys that were in there are total volunteer that day. Nobody got paid. Some of the media is reporting that they were hired. No, they were total volunteers, and you can't expect them to stay away from their job and things of that nature for an extended amount of time. In the same time, we got some phone calls out of Los Angeles from people that I've worked with as far as, you know, putting specials together on bounty hunting and all that. And
right.
One of them said, hey, what if we paid up to $200,000 expenses for a more thorough, bigger search, and we had an exclusivity? Well, I told him the exclusivity is difficult because it's a public park and the media is going to be in there, so it's not like you're just going to be another camera.
Sure, right.
So they said, well, can we get together on it when you come back? And I said, yeah. So at that time, I told Todd, the kid that was running the search, I says, let me see what we can do about coming up with some money, and then we'll come back. But I'll keep in touch with you, and I'll let you know.
Now, I don't know if you know this or not, and I'm not sure if you can even comment on this or not.
I know what you're going to tell me.
But I'd like you to comment on Todd Wozinski and what's
okay.
been reported
Here's
today.
What happened. We did not contact him. He contacted us.
Okay.
And I got to tell you, I appreciate the kid. I have no problem with him. He called us on Wednesday night and says, I got some blackwater divers. Because we had decided, okay, Kaylee's in there, but we're not going to search anymore because we don't have people capable, and certainly not with just two people. He says, I've got divers available, he says, and we're blackwater people. We met with them that night, and he said, I'll have people in the water tomorrow morning to see what we can do down there, you know, kind of exploratory. And I said, okay, that's fine. Now, when Detective Allen threw his hissy fit out there, the next day, I'm talking to one of the FBI agents in the cop shop, and Allen grabs the phone from the FBI guy and reads me that this kid had resigned from the sheriff's office because they had confronted him with him having lied about his experiences in the military.
Right.
And I told him, I said, well, first of all, you know, I don't know of too many people that don't lie about their military experiences. You know, everybody slept with more women than they really did, and... on fire, killed more people, and all that crap.
Right.
I said, so, you know, that doesn't bother me. What I am impressed with is the fact that he is very professional in the way he puts his people in the water, the way he pulls them out. in the whole thing. I says, furthermore, I'm not so sure you're supposed to be reading me an internal memo.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that upset him more, because I have no reason, if we go back there, to not use Todd in that water and let him lead the dive.
One last question for you, Leonard. I know you're busy. The polygraph, what's happening with that?
I told them while I was there, the FBI, I spoke to them Friday. I says, hey, when do you want to do this? Because I had scheduled myself leaving Saturday or Sunday. And I said, and he said, well, our polygrapher is out of town. He's not here right now. I said, okay. He said, but don't worry about it. If you go back to Sacramento, we'll come out there and do it out there.
And have you heard from them?
I talked to him today, and there was discussion. See, I think what Alan is concerned about is that somebody did something, which we didn't. He was mad at me. He spoke to me privately and said, you know, that as far as he was concerned, I was running a scam. I was making money off this. He didn't believe a thing came out of my mouth. And I told him, well, I can, you know, at least you're being honest about it. He's just upset and rambling and ranting and raving to a certain extent. But he's got to sit down and become a cop somewhere along the line and say, hey, you know, it doesn't matter if it came to us from the media. He accused me of having called the media first. Well, no, the first guy I called was Nick Savage, the FBI agent, and that's what I was told to do. You come up with something or you think you got something, you call me. That's who I called. The media was out there since 5 in the morning. They're the ones that called Alan, and that's why he got upset. We didn't call the media. They get up earlier than the roosters do.
Well, I've said it many times in my program. I don't care if it's you or Mickey Mouse in short pants. Kaylee Anthony needs to be found.
Exactly. That's the whole thing. We're in this together. Now, I think one of the things that upset him is maybe, just maybe, they didn't put divers in the water at Blanchard Park. And that has always been a high priority on everybody's list. When we met Tim Miller and told him what information we had, what led us to putting divers in there was the cross that was found by the playground. And it had beads in it that our girl that stayed with Casey identified as being beads out of the same little box that Casey had in the room. So, and we had two pictures, not just Lisa, which is Tim Miller's girlfriend, but another young lady that took a picture back in August when they were searching the park. Now, at that time, somebody should have woke up and said, wait a minute, maybe we better check the water.
Yeah. No, and the whole thing is, Leonard, and I'm going to let you go in about 10 seconds here, is the little girl needs to be found. You're taking flack. Tim Miller's taking flack. Everyone's taking flack here, but the investigation needs to continue, and I want to thank you for stopping on tonight.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
Bye-bye. The whole question about Blackwater and the credibility of this Todd Bozinski is the subject of a story at WFTV.com. I'm sure if you watch Nancy Grace tonight, you'll see that this owner of Blackwater Divers, Bozinski, if I'm pronouncing that right, lied about his service in Iraq and Afghanistan and resigned from the Orange County Sheriff's Department as a trainee. Does that question his credibility as far as diving? Maybe. Maybe Todd Bozinski should be taking a polygraph test, not Leonard Padilla. Like I say, I don't give a damn. I don't like how Leonard Padilla has done some of this, although he's doing it. I don't like how some of this has been reported and carried on, but it's being done. Let's hope that the powers to be, the prosecution in this case, has a good case, and that when it does come to trial, justice is served. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. And we are right back. And what I thought I would do is open the phone lines for 5 minutes or so. Area code 306-842-7884. You've had a lot to digest tonight, right from the anatomy of a crime to human trafficking to Joran the Snake Vandersloot to Leonard Padilla to Mark Williams to Kaylee Anthony. We cover it all here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We try to give the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Isn't that what they say? No sensationalism, just the facts. And I think that's important when it comes down to broadcasting these sorts of stories. 306-842-7884 if you want to get your thoughts in. You know, when we first started covering the Natalie Holloway story all these years ago now, I knew, or at least I hoped then, that it wouldn't be still talked about years later. But then as we went on broadcasting it, here we are all these years later, and we're still talking about it, and Joran Vandersloot is still getting away with it. But maybe that will change. Hi, you're on the air.
data. It's Red calling from his sick bed.
How are you feeling, buddy? You've been down and out for a couple weeks now.
Oh, man. It's the thing that will not go away.
Is that right? It's kind of like I called Joran van der Sloot, and I'll get in trouble for it tonight, the snake that won't go away. He kind of crawls out from under his rock, and then he goes and he hides back under it as soon as the heat gets on, or am I wrong?
Well, is it any different than he's ever been?
No.
I mean, if there's one thing we can count on is... Joran van der Sloot will make sure that this case continues.
Yep.
He cannot stay out of the public eye. He obviously, I mean, the man has no conscience.
No.
I mean, how you can continuously, you know, first you're a drug dealer wannabe, then you're a pimp trafficking sex trader, you know, gun running and terrorism is next, I guess, on his list.
And you heard the, I'm not sure if you did, you heard the mom whose daughter may have been or fell victim to human trafficking, and you hear the emotion in her voice, and you see that bastard, van der Sloot, on video with these young girls, pimping them into a life of prostitution, you know. Great for Peter DeVries to get this, but it's time the authorities do something with them.
I mean, of all places, Thailand, you know, the sex trade capital of the world, you wonder whether anyone's going to do anything there. You would kind of hope that maybe Holland finally does something with this. I mean, if you think about it, Dana, I mean, you're a cop, but come on. I mean, what kind of a retrobate goes to a hotel room, deals with sex slave traffickers? I mean, you have to really be a scumbag. I mean, you don't get any lower than this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that this is the cutesy boy, the little sporter that everyone wanted to make him out to be. He, you know, Aruba's finest little, you know, misunderstood boy. And how many people do you know at one point, like I said, want to be a drug trafficker?
Yeah.
Now they're in sex trafficking.
Yeah.
I mean, at what point does this person, not that I'm making a prediction here, but it's going down this road. Some point, he's going to be in the wrong hotel room at the wrong time with the wrong people.
Yep, and like I told Beth Holloway one time on the program, justice is served in many ways. He may not get it in a court, but he's going to get it eventually. It's just a matter of time. But I want to change gears a little bit, and I know you're not feeling well, so I appreciate you calling. The Anthony case. Boy, oh boy, you know, I did the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da thing here a little while ago, and I certainly am not a circus musician, but this story has gone every which way that it can, and in fact, it to the point that I debated even talking about it tonight because it's been such a circus.
Yeah, I mean, I took a little flack from some people myself for, you know, putting a big top on the front of Scared Monkeys and basically calling Leonard Padilla the ringmaster of a three-ring circus, of which is interchangeable with, you know, probably with the Anthonys at this point.
Right.
You almost don't know where to start with this. We could see it coming a mile away. I really wish that some people had listened to me a while ago and had cut some ties with some people so that this kind of stuff would not go on.
Yep.
I would say, frankly, as your interviews were going on, I think I was getting more hostile and more hostile as I was listening. To Mark Williams, I mean, I've enjoyed, you know, many of the things that he's had to say on Nancy Grace, although a couple things he's gotten wrong, because he's only surrounded himself with Leonard Padilla.
Yep.
He should get to know Tim Miller. I think he would have a different perspective on life.
I agree.
And just a word to the wise to Mark Williams, there is a responsible side of the internet and there's an irresponsible side of the internet. And I don't need any media types telling me about getting stories wrong. I read them every day on the New York Times.
Mm-hmm. It's not true. And if it wasn't for organizations like yours and the small part that I play in it, we have scooped mainstream media for years now with the right story. I call it main street media versus mainstream media, because guys like Mark Williams, who are you know, behind the booth in a fancy radio station, just don't understand the power of the internet and what we're doing. And I'm really going to stir the pot here right now, my friend. And what we're doing is being disserviced by someone running around with a video camera. I just don't like it, and it's bugging me.
Well, I can't say that I don't. I can't say that I disagree with you, Dana. I mean, we have for years now put together many, many people. There are many talented people on the internet who do tremendous research, do tremendous investigative stuff behind the scenes that sometimes doesn't make it to the front pages, whether it be of Scared Monkeys, of other sites, or even onto radio. It goes directly to law enforcement. Sometimes we do put out comments. Sometimes I'll put out a cryptic message every so often that people are supposed to kind of draw from.
Yep.
But, I mean, the internet in many respects, and when I refer to this, it's the responsible side of the internet. It is the investigative journalism that used to be done by the media,
right,
which is no longer done by the media. And frankly, someone running around with a video camera is no different than cable news and lazy journalism, because frankly, I think it's amazing, and I've seen it in the past with the many people at Scared Monkeys on the forums and on the front page, the investigative work that they did in the Holloway case.
Unbelievable.
That made it, yep, to law enforcement, that went to attorneys, that is actually part of lawsuits right now, mm-hmm, as discovery evidence. And it goes on and on. To those people who do that great stuff and who want to, who sleuth on the internet, I say go for it. But to just basically have a camera going 24/7 and responding off of that, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't watch Jerry Springer.
No, it's voyeurism, and that's my opinion, and many will criticize me for it, but I know the work that we do. I know the work that the forum members do, and it's amazing. And I've been doing investigations on the other side for many, many, many years. The type of good questions, the type of intuitiveness that people on our forums can pick up. They can pick up the little mistakes here, the little mistakes there, or he said this or he said that. And it's something that the Gretas and the Nancy Graces and the Geraldos and all these guys should learn from, because they're just running with whatever they can put on tape. And if something's wrong, well, they'll deal with it later. And that's not journalism, in my point.
Well, Dana, it's a soundbite. And it's the same soundbite over and over and over. It's hard work doing the investigative side of these cases. It really, truly is. And I mean, I've been privy and have had the pleasure and the benefit to deal with some real people who, behind the scenes, do some absolutely amazing work. And much of the stuff that you see that sometimes the media breaks finally is done by these people.
Yep.
The background work is done by John Q. Public. It's not being done by producers. It's not, certainly not being done by the hosts. And that's the reason why you generally have these cases where, you know, the pundits half the time don't know what they're talking about.
isn't that true?
And I would be remiss to say this, because this really, truly, and I'll use it, hell, it's Scared Monkeys Radio, I can say this, pissed me off.
Yep.
I would say to Leonard Padilla, you know what? Everyone in the military doesn't lie.
That's right.
How dare you? You know what? Speak for yourself. That's all I have to say.
Yep. Well, I think
everyone that I deal with that's presently in the military, in Iraq, or have served in other wars, you know what? They didn't lie.
Yep.
They don't have to. When you've got honor, you don't have to lie.
Yep. It's called honor. Is
when law enforcement asks you to take a poly, there's a reason for it, and don't let them bullshit you as to the as to any other reason why.
It's credibility, and the credibility factor is sinking this case.
I mean, hell, they asked the guy to take a poly, and then all of a sudden the diver, the head diver of the that's doing his search, turns out to be a liar himself. I mean, come on.
Yep.
We don't have much in life to go on, but credibility, honor, and character. That's what basically we're all made of. It's our choice what we do with that.
You and I were attacked by a former spokesperson for the Anthony family. We were called liars. Our credibility was questioned. And the old saying, what goes around comes around, came around big time. And I'm still smiling. But
you think?
Yeah. It's just... That's crazy out there right now. But when it comes right down to it, this case is going to be tried. Nancy Grace will go on to another story someplace else. Henry Lee and Kobolinski and all these people involved will talk about something else. But one thing that I can guarantee for sure, and I'm going to end up on this because I'm running out of voice here and so are you, is that the people that listen to my program, our program here at Scared Monkeys, the people on the forum, the people on the front page, you, Doug, class, everybody involved, we care. And we have credibility because we speak what we feel. We don't come out and say, hell, everybody lies about being a medic in Iraq. I'm going to use them anyway. No, the credibility sucks. I wanted the people to hear what he had to say. I'm glad he's searching, but how he's doing it is wrong. And that whole circus atmosphere crap and that guy running around, that video camera crap has got to end.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree, Dana, and I would just like to end on this note, and that's I spoke to Tim Miller this afternoon. He's in Bryant, Texas, which is right near College Station, Texas, home of Texas A&M Aggies, and they have been doing a search since they left what was the Circus of Florida, and they found the young man this afternoon with no media, with no circus. Barnum and Bailey was not there, but they did their job as they've always done. Are they perfect? No. Far from it. Tim Miller's the first person to admit that. Do they make mistakes? Of course they do. But what they do is they search and they search and they search. And they don't care if you're a man, woman, child, black, brown, white, or pink. They do the job to help families get closure. They've got the track record, and they have the credibility, and they actually do what some of these other nonprofit organizations can't seem to do. They find kids.
Yep. No, and that's so true. Red, my friend, get some rest, get healthy, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you, Dana. Great show, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye. That's it. That's the Dana Pretzer Show for tonight. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. I will be a guest on the Justice Interrupted radio program a little bit later on this evening. If you're wondering where that is or how to listen to it, send me an email, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, and I can point you in the right direction. Thank you to all of my guests. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.